This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for the week ending 13 May 2016 for Expressions of Peace, Personal, Powerful, and Heart to Heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace radio tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With global extreme weather as the organizing principle, Sequitur covers habitat destruction, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as a result of human activity. Sequitur moves from our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels to a place of acceptance of the natural consequences of those actions. Sequitur. It follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zympht. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. More of his work is linked at panina.org, or you can find him on SoundCloud. Last week, I opened with a personal dedication for some dear ones on the other side of our planet. I intend to continue with the tradition of sharing a small personal or artistic touch with you each week, such as a reading or a song or a story. This week, I offer the invocation I read at the launch of Panina 3.0 on Tercero de Mayo at a dinner gathering at the Black Mountain Inn in Black Mountain, North Carolina, hosted by innkeeper and dear friend June Bergeron. I adapted it from the prologue to Starhawk's new book, City of Refuge. Here, then, is the declaration of the four sacred things. In company with cultures of many different times and places, we name these things as sacred: air, fire, water, and earth. Whether we see them as the breath, energy, blood, and body of the mother, or as the blessed gifts of a creator, or as symbols of the interconnected systems that sustain life, we know that nothing can live without them. To call these things sacred is to say that they have a value beyond their usefulness for human ends. The earth is a living, conscious being. All beings are part of the earth life, and so are sacred. Only ecological balance can sustain freedom. Only in freedom can that fifth sacred thing we call spirit flourish in its full diversity. To this, we dedicate our curiosity, our will, our courage, our silences, and our voices. To honor the sacred is to create conditions in which nourishment, sustenance, habitat, knowledge, freedom, and beauty can thrive. To honor the sacred is to make love possible. Aho. So let us start with fire. As of last week, 88,000 people have been evacuated and 10,000 hectares have been affected in the Fort McMurray, Alberta, Canada fire. The Washington Post reports that satellite imagery clearly shows the smoke plume traveling southeastward as far as Florida. Aretha Van Herk reports in the Life's Journey blog that 20% of the population of Fort McMurray are economic refugees from the Maritime Provinces, and 30% are employed in the resource extraction industries. The LA Times describes three possible ways Canadians are interpreting this apocalyptic event. Nature is lashing back at those who mistreat it in the name of profit. The inferno is a natural consequence of conditions consistent with climate change. The evacuees are climate refugees, and nature is striking with academic irony, not vengeance, in a place that helps supply the world with fossil fuel. The fire is a random setback the oil industry will find a way to overcome. The fire is expected to grow, potentially doubling in size, since substantial rain is the only thing that will stop it, and there is little in the forecast. Chris Dulcey blogs at Vunderground about the convergence of four factors that create ideal conditions for this wildfire event. Dry vegetation due to a mere 60% of normal precipitation in the first 4 months of the year, with only 1 millimeter in the 3 weeks prior to the blaze, and abnormally dry conditions since the end of March. Strong winds of almost 30 kilometers per hour last Saturday when the fire started, and returning on Tuesday at 35 kilometers per hour with a shift from the east to the southwest. Humidity in the low double digits, which contributed to the drying of vegetation and provided more fuel for the fire. temperatures as much as 5°C above average after a 13°C increase from 3 days earlier due to a strong high-pressure ridge across western Canada, which allowed El Niño to feed a steady stream of warm air to the region. According to Daniel Thomas, a fire research scientist with Natural Resources Canada in Edmonton, El Niño brought a dry fall and very little snow throughout the winter, reports the Chicago Tribune. In the last week, record temperatures along with a steady dry breeze added to the tinderbox environment. Thompson described the same chain of events diagonally across the Pacific in Indonesia. A total of 1.5 million acres have burned across the U.S. in the first 4 months of 2016, reports CTV. Columbia University climate and ecology scientist Park Williams estimates that global warming is responsible for about half of that increase. And the other half? In their analysis of the causes of these fire outbreaks around the world, they mention land use twice with subtle reference to agricultural practices in the global south. Yet they report that the U.S. 10-year average number of acres burned in wildfires has more than doubled from 3 million acres in the mid-80s to 7 million acres now, with a similar pattern in Siberia, while the worldwide total has dropped. Especially since methane emissions have been acknowledged as potential fuel for wildfires in the thawing tundra, I wonder why nobody seems to be talking about the methane emissions from the fracking fields as a fuel source for North American fires. Food and Water Watch reports that measures have been passed against fracking in 525 communities in 22 states, Washington, D.C., and three First Nations, says the Athens, Ohio News. Robert Scribler reports on a fire outbreak that has been sweeping northward from drought-parched Southeast Asia through China and Mongolia to its current location in the Lake Baikal region of southern Russia, on its way to the thawing, dried-out Siberian tundra with its rich store of peat and methane fuels. It is not unlikely that it will reach the polar regions, where it will contribute to the faster-than-predicted melting of the polar sea ice. The best coverage we have, complete with some terrifying photographs from this sparsely settled inland area of Asia with its negligible economic importance, is from the Siberian Times. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration satellite imagery is also telling. The plume from Lake Baikal is visible 1,600 kilometers away off the coast in the Sea of Japan. Several thousand firefighters have been deployed, including military personnel and equipment, including aircraft and paratroopers. The Times of India reports that the military has been deployed to keep order as 5,500 hectares of forest fire in Uttarakhand burn out of control. Al Jazeera reports that Sri Lanka and Pakistan are also being affected. Of course, the contribution of these colossal blazes to carbon dioxide emissions, particulate pollution, and surface warming is highly significant. Such major wildfire events create their own weather, most notably pyrocumulus clouds that deliver winds locally as well as lightning bolts, and thus contribute to the spread of the fire rather than to precipitation that might help to extinguish it. At least drought doesn't create emissions, right? The Orthodox Breaking Israel News reports that the Middle East and Africa will be harder hit by global warming than other parts of the world. The number of exceptionally hot days has doubled since 1970 and is expected to increase fivefold in the coming years and decades. Adding airborne desert dust resulting from widespread droughts leads Joseph Lilleveld, director at the Max Planck Institute, to conclude, quote, "The climate in large parts of the Middle East and North Africa could change in such a manner that the very existence of its inhabitants is in jeopardy," close quote. Al Jazeera reports that the landlocked West African country of Burkina Faso is having water and power shortages due to drought. A report for the LA Times by Auburn University research scientist Esther Ngumbi illustrates how lives can be improved in drought-ridden Africa through use of relatively inexpensive and universally available cell phone technology to disseminate research findings and best practices such as drip irrigation, introduction of beneficial soil microbes, and shifting to drought-resistant crops. Take Part reports on text-based, crowdsourced knowledge and service networks patterned on the Uber model in Kenya and Uganda. In an article in Reuters titled, How to Stop People Dying from Aid Shortages, Megan Rowling states that, quote, sometimes the lack of aid directly causes deaths, unquote, and cites 250,000 deaths in the 2012-2013 Somalia famine, quote, where fighting hampered the delivery of aid, unquote. Say what? Attributing the collateral damage of war to the inefficiency of humanitarian aid delivery is a great way to prop up the power of the cash economy and flog the fundraisers into ever greater productivity. Besides, no amount of aid will bribe the crops to grow and the wells to flow. I almost didn't make it to the end of the article where Rowling finally says that, quote, the best solution is to shrink the size of urgent aid needs by putting more political effort and cash into resolving conflicts and protecting people better from extreme weather, earthquakes, and other natural hazards, close quote. UN Humanitarian Chief Stephen O'Brien adds, quote, you have to reduce the demand as much as you have to meet the need, unquote. And then there's this travesty by the World Bank, reported by ReliefWeb. A range of associations, aid organizations, government agencies, and private sector stakeholders likely thought they were contributing to, quote, the ongoing dialogue about measures to reduce the vulnerability and enhance the resilience of populations living in drylands areas of sub-Saharan Africa, close quote. But the final compilation is titled, Confronting Drought in Africa's Drylands, Opportunities for Enhancing Resilience. Say what? It seems to me that confronting an insurmountable opponent like drought only increases vulnerability, and that the juxtaposition of those two phrases is tantamount to telling Africa's drylands to suck it up, that their suffering builds character. Resilience is not a euphemism for tolerance for abuse. With the restoration of the snowpack in March, the Weather Channel officially declared an end to the 5-year drought in California in spite of El Niño's northward shift this past winter. With the scarcity of rain, it is premature melting of the snowpack that has been responsible for the restoration of water levels in the reservoirs, so conservation is still the order of the day, especially with La Niña on her way. The UC Santa Cruz News Center reports that this was the most severe drought in the southwestern U.S. in 1,200 years. Brazilian and Argentine government grain agencies are blaming record losses in South American corn and soybeans on extreme weather, reports AgWeb. The drought in Venezuela is taking a toll on the water available to generate hydropower, reports AccuWeather. Federal employees are working a 2-day week. There are 4-hour daily blackouts, and women have been asked to curtail their use of hair dryers? Say what? I can think of no better interface between fire and water than a hydroelectric dam. So before we move to oceanic concerns, let's look at Sea Globe's coverage of water diplomacy in Southeast Asia along the Mekong River, the mother of water, a 4,909-kilometer waterway with its source in the Tibetan High Plateau that makes its way through China, Myanmar, Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. In the lower Mekong Basin, about 60 million people rely on the waterway as a source of food and income. Due to the advantages of its terrain, Laos depends on the river for its power generation. The Cambodian people get 81% of their protein from fish from the Mekong River. Three main political entities have influence over the management of the Mekong. 1. Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam are the Mekong River Commission, but they have no authority over policy. So in spite of the recommendation for a moratorium on dams, there are 11 dams under construction or in the planning stages in the lower basin alone. China is conspicuously absent from the commission and has 7 dams already constructed and at least 20 more in the planning or building stages in the upper basin. 2. Another puppet organization on this stage from which China is conspicuously absent is the U.S.-led Lower Mekong Initiative, which to its credit at least includes Myanmar. So far, it has not addressed the water management part of its three-part mandate, but has been active only with education and human health issues related to the river. 3. The Langkang Mekong Corporation is a China-sponsored group that includes the other five in its membership, but provincial concerns still trump regional cooperation. In response to the current drought, China released water from its dams and Laos followed suit, but Thailand sucked it all up for their rice fields before Vietnam and Cambodia could get any to drink. DHI, a Danish water research company, predicts annual farming and fishery losses of $450 million in Cambodia and more than $760 million in Vietnam, as well as a 50% decrease in fish catches in both countries and 10% of the fish species simply disappearing from the Mekong. In regional extreme weather news, Myanmar, 21 people have died in the second half of April, reports New China. Some 59,000 people have been affected and 1,900 homes and 1,700 pagodas have been destroyed. Laos, El Nino-driven drought continues for another week or two, predicts Radio Free Asia. Any precipitation that does occur will continue to be in the form of severe tropical storms, often including hail. Vietnam. Fresh Plaza reports that a fruit festival was canceled due to $1.435 million in damages from saltwater intrusion, affecting some 8,000 hectares of plantations. 2,000 hectares of fruit trees have been ravaged and over 350,000 saplings have withered. According to CNBC, due to El Nino, and for the first time in decades, despite continuing growth in the Vietnamese economy as a whole, the agricultural sector had net losses of 2.69%. One person was killed and five were injured when lightning struck a family gathered at their dinner table, reports the Phnom Penh Post. Another person was injured in a separate strike. Five market stalls and 18 houses were damaged in the storm. There have been 12 people killed and 60 injured in extreme weather events in Vietnam so far this year. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, is a political and economic organization formed in 1967 by Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, and Thailand that has since expanded to include Brunei, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, and Vietnam. Last October, ASEAN set a target for the region to be haze-free by 2020. In a winning high school essay about Singapore's air quality published in the Straits Times, Audrey Tan says that Indonesia-based palm oil, pulp, and paper industries are the major sources of the haze, which was worse than ever last year due to El Nino, but that, quote, it must not be forgotten that supply is driven by demand, unquote. Tan reported with skepticism that Indonesian President Joko Widodo proposed last month to stop allowing new land to be used for oil palm plantations, and she points more optimistically to some proactive measures implemented in Singapore that might be effective at eliminating the regional particulate pollution problem by 2020 if only they were regionally adopted. The 2014 Transboundary Haze Pollution Act provides for fines for those causing or condoning fires that have resulted in unhealthy levels of haze. The federal government of Singapore sent notices to six Indonesia-based firms to request information about the steps they are taking to put out and prevent fires on their land. Last month, the government resolved, effective in September, to buy paper products only from suppliers that bear the Singapore Green label, which certifies sustainable forestry management practices. The Star reports that in spite of drought conditions, Malaysia's Taiping zoo animals are getting plenty of water. However, Reuters reports that populations of elephant, rhino, and lion on Zimbabwe's reserves are not as fortunate as the drought has forced the government there to sell them off to reduce the strain on limited public funding. One person was killed, 300 were evacuated from their homes, and 400 buildings were damaged when a severe storm hit northern China last Tuesday, reports 50 Weather. Strong winds lifted an entire building and slammed it to the ground. Damages are estimated at more than $60 million. The next day, one person was injured in the southwest when a storm flattened the scaffolding of an outdoor market, reports the UK Daily Mail. Al Jazeera reports that at least 33 people were killed in a landslide caused by torrential rains at a power station in southern China early this week. The Yangtze River is up to 4 meters higher than normal, and 80 centimeters of floodwater trapped drivers in their cars. Arctic sea ice was a popular research topic with the Washington Post this week. A paper to be published Monday in the International Journal of Climatology confirms an uptick in the frequency of high-pressure blocking events over Greenland since the 1980s. Such systems both cause and are caused by Arctic sea ice loss and the consequent unstable jet stream. An earlier paper from the Journal of Climate drew the same conclusion based on data going all the way back to 1851. A third paper published last month reported a record low for the maximum extent of Arctic sea ice for the second consecutive year this past winter and named two outcomes: an increase in the amount of sunlight that penetrates the darkening surface rather than being reflected back into space by the glistening ice and snow, and the weakening of the atmospheric circulation patterns due to the decrease in the temperature gradient between the equator and the poles. Eva Holland reports on the commercialization of the Northwest Passage due to declining sea ice for Pacific Standard Magazine's May-June water issue. In 2013, the Nordic Orion became the first commercial cargo vessel to complete the transit. It was carrying coal. What used to be a body of water that took explorers 2 months to cross, towing their ship between the bergs in rowboats or hauling her through the jam-packed ice on foot, has been reduced to an easy 2-day sail on ice-free waters. Canada claims that the Northwest Passage is part of their interior waterways, but the rest of the world disagrees. Nature remains an unpredictable obstacle, and search and rescue infrastructure remains sparse. Most of the islands are part of the Canadian territory of Nunavut, which in 1999 gained independence from its older western neighbor, the Northwest Territories. With an area nearly the size of Mongolia, the islands are home to fewer than 20,000 people. Many of Nunavut's hamlets lie north of the Arctic Circle, and none are reachable by road. There are no telephone wires or fiber optic cables. Internet, television, and landline telephones depend on microwave transmission. Electricity is diesel-generated, but there are no pipelines. Fuel is housed in tank farms and arrives by ship during late August and early September. All bulk goods arrive by sea or are flown in by commercial jet at a staggering cost. Hunting and fishing remain primary activities, including seals, whales, and polar bears. 11 small ships run by 8 small touring companies sail to or within Nunavut. In 2015, 30 voyages were scheduled territory-wide, 9 of which had to be canceled due to ice conditions. The remaining 21 brought some 2,900 passengers to the region. In the Northwest Passage itself, Transport Canada recorded just 2 complete transits and 3 partial transits last year, by ships carrying 100 to 300 passengers each. As of this year, Crystal Cruises plans to be the first major line to get in on the action and will double 2015's numbers in a single cruise. The potential for large-scale, abrupt economic and cultural change is apocalyptic. McGill University geographer James Ford finds that while unstable sea ice in warmer seas is more dangerous for Inuit hunters, traditional knowledge has been inadequately passed down to young hunters who now lack the skills to go over the ice safely. Oh? And what young hunters are those? The ones whose parents were sold on the value of sending them to Ivy League MBA programs so they could pass judgment on their parents for eating aquatic mammals and become human resources for the extraction industries? Ford says, quote, "In many cases, climate change is just a trigger on underlying issues," unquote. Just a trigger? Make no mistake, dear followers, this particular trigger is a powerful catalyst that opens the region to cultural imperialism, which further accelerates the melting of the Arctic in a classic self-reinforcing feedback loop. Inuk documentary filmmaker Althea Arnakuk-Baril told Indian Country Today that in another blow to the Inuit way of life, Dominic Gagnon's film Of the North is based on inauthentic sources about non-native people compiled by a man who has never been to the far north, in defiance of international ethical standards. Another Inuk visual artist and filmmaker, Stephen Agluvak Poskas, says that the movie transmits an insulting and fake reality and promotes racial stereotypes. Shishmaref, Alaska, population 582, is a village of indigenous people on Sarachev Island, just north of the Bering Strait. Unlike the residents of Louisiana's Île de Jean Charles, Shishmaref citizens have not been awarded any relocation funding in spite of the imminent threat of inundation, according to a report in The Guardian by Georgetown Climate Center's executive director, Vicky Arroyo. She makes the point that, like the residents of Île de Jean Charles, the contribution of these non-industrialized people to anthropogenic climate change has been virtually zero. She articulates the often blurred distinction between migrants and refugees, quote, "It's not that we are leaving home, but that home is leaving us," unquote. In a report in the International News, Sindh Environmental Protection Agency Provincial Director Naeem Mughal claimed that the same is true of Pakistan, which is among 10 countries most affected by prolonged droughts, torrential rains, and other extreme weather patterns linked to or exacerbated by climate change, especially in its agricultural sector, but which has been responsible for less than 1% of the factors leading to climate change. In southeastern India, panic ruled as thunderstorms with strong winds and hail abruptly struck the drought-ravaged land, killing two people and destroying both crops and herds, reports TV9. People remember too clearly the floods that killed 5,000 people just 3 years ago. Sam Bickersteth, head of the Climate and Development Knowledge Network, describes the link between climate change and alcoholism and domestic abuse in India for Truthout. Quote, "You can't look at climate change in a silo. We need to integrate it into social cohesion," unquote. Al Jazeera reports that at least 49 people were killed in landslides and flooding due to torrential rain in the landlocked East African country of Rwanda this week. Dozens of people were injured, with at least 26 requiring hospital treatment. Nearly 5,000 homes were destroyed, leaving thousands of people homeless. The Weather Channel reports a unique set of circumstances in Nevada that resulted in a 7.5-centimeter accumulation of hail. Snowplows were deployed. Mount Washington and other parts of New Hampshire had up to 6.5 centimeters of Mother's Day snow, reports WMUR. The death toll from last weekend's flooding in Texas is up to 6, reports the Weather Network. In the same storm, the streets of Lake Charles, Louisiana, became waterways when backed-up storm drains were overwhelmed by more than 25 centimeters of rain. The storm spawned 7 tornadoes in Texas and Oklahoma. After record-breaking flooding in the UK this past winter, an exponential increase in subsidence is expected due to the contraction of the saturated land as it dries out, explains The Telegraph. Around 16,000 property owners currently make subsidence claims annually. Subsidence requires different insurance coverage from flooding due to storms or sea level rise, and different coverage from erosion due to tides and wave action. Floods and erosion are threatening more than 1,000 landfills in England and Wales, reports The Guardian. These predate dumping regulations and are likely to contain heavy metals and chemical toxins that pose a threat to agricultural plants and animals, as well as to wildlife. Bad weather has been blamed for the years-long delay and a 30% cost increase to clean up the Cathkin Braes landfill in the north of England, which is now not only flooded, but also contaminated. Shifting focus to air. The same instability in the jet stream that causes the blocking high pressure systems over Greenland that provides an open door for warm air from the Gulf of Mexico to penetrate Canada's far north is also responsible for a buildup of high pressure as far south as Bermuda and the Azores, providing a corridor for hot, dry air to flow northward from the tropical Atlantic and deliver a hot, sunny summer to the UK that is likely to set 40-year heatwave records, predicts the Express. Single-day high-temperature records are also likely to topple. Drought and fires are likely. This is a complete reversal of previous forecasts calling for a cooler-than-usual summer. Based on satellite data, NASA reported more than 67 tornadoes between 25 April and 2 May, mostly in Tornado Alley, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska. The storm system that spawned them brought up to 30 centimeters of heavy rain to Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, Arkansas, and Mississippi. Indiana and Kentucky were also affected, as well as parts of Ohio and North Carolina. The Guardian reports that roads and schools were closed in Tasmania early last week due to 110 kilometer per hour winds and 7 meter swells. The coast of Victoria was also threatened. 15,000 properties lost power, and it was a rough ride on the Spirit of Tasmania ferry. Perth, Australia dropped nearly 8 c between last Saturday morning's minimum and Sunday's, resulting in single-digit temperatures about 6 degrees below the average for this time of year, reports WA Today. Low humidity and a brisk breeze added a significant wind chill factor. A few days later, low pressure brought strong wind and rain to Tasmania, South Australia, New South Wales, and Victoria, reports Yahoo 7. The Philippine Inquirer published a speech by Energy Development Corporation's Federico Lopez to the Climate Reality Project in Manila a few weeks ago, in which he shared lessons learned from Typhoon Yolanda Haiyan. The most profound one was the importance of embodied reflexive collaboration, even when it means trusting strangers or adversaries. On the other hand, he affirmed that EDC is, quote, employing many engineering solutions that will typhoon-proof our energy facilities to withstand the 300 kilometer per hour winds of the future, unquote. Say what? A quick Google search reveals that Haiyan delivered gusts up to 315 kilometers per hour. But the public sector is even worse as they build replacement school buildings rated for 250 kilometer per hour winds. 17 passengers were injured last Saturday when Hong Kong Airlines flight CRK-6704 hit turbulence over Borneo after taking off from Denpasar on Bali, reports RTHK. Last Wednesday, an Etihad Airways flight was hit by severe and unexpected turbulence just before landing in Jakarta, injuring 31 people. And this Sunday, a flight from Atlanta to Chicago made an emergency landing in Tennessee after turbulence tore off an engine cover, reports the Christian Science Monitor. Another turbulence incident this week included injuries to 7 people on a flight from the Dominican Republic to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The Sydney Morning Herald reports that the decommissioning of the Scientific Division of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization will begin on Monday with the serving of notice to the first 74 of 275 planned layoffs and the closure of the Melbourne-based Paleoclimate Science Unit. A senior scientist familiar with the ICE program said, quote, Australia can't just divest itself of important global capability without there being consequences, close quote, and added that models would make less accurate forecasts without the guidance gained from greater understanding of past climates, such as from ice cores. Minority political parties are vocal in their opposition to these layoffs and are urging delay until after the 2 July election results clarify the will of the people. Business Insurance reports that insured losses due to severe storms and flooding have already resulted in more than $3 billion nationwide during the first 4 months of the year, with Texas hit multiple times during the period. Chicago-based meteorologist Steve Bowen says the insurance industry has incurred more than $7.5 billion in losses from winter storms, severe convective storms, flooding, and drought so far this year. He says the convective storms have topped $10 billion in insured losses every year since 2008, and this year is well on its way to continuing the trend, with the 1 June to 30 November Atlantic hurricane season forecast to produce 12 to 14 named storms, with 6 to 8 being hurricanes and 3 to 4 being major hurricanes. But Insurance Business America reports that Warren Buffett assured his investors that climate change will actually benefit the insurance industry. Quote, "The upward march in loss costs has made insurance companies far more valuable. If costs had remained unchanged, Berkshire would now own an auto insurer doing $600 million of business annually, rather than one doing $23 billion." Close quote. Yes, car insurance is important for commuters who are expected to drive to work even when driving conditions are treacherous. And I'm sure Buffett's marketing department will come up with clever fear-mongering techniques to make people willing to pay ever higher premiums for insurance. The Commission on Human Rights of the Philippines has brought suit against BP and others, including ExxonMobil and Chevron, for the failure of their policies and procedures to appropriately protect the human rights of the thousands whose lives have been lost or ruined by extreme weather events directly attributable to rampant resource extraction, reports Sputnik International. So how can BP have first quarter profits of more than $500 million in spite of plummeting oil prices when earlier projections called for losses of nearly $250 million? For one thing, those earnings represent an 80% drop from $2.6 billion in the same period of 2015. And, even when they lose, they win. The court has ordered BP to pay $20 billion in damages arising from the Deepwater Horizon disaster in the Gulf of Mexico 5 years ago, $5.5 billion for Clean Water Act penalties, and the rest to the five Gulf states and 400 local governments which suffered from the ecological disaster. Between this judgment, the $28 billion in cleanup operations and compensations already paid, and the thousands of suits still pending, eventual payouts may exceed $53 billion. Yet, except for the Clean Water Act portion, all damages, including punitive damages, as well as restitution and other remedial payments, are 100% tax deductible. Meanwhile, in the Norwegian North Sea, all 235 employees have been evacuated from the BP floating oil field Valhall, a barge the size of a football stadium, deployed in 1982 after it went adrift in rough weather. Thanks for following Sequitur on Expressions of Peace Radio, archived at panina.org. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston. We'll be right back.
confusion is so clear. Harton's need dissolves all power through the needle's eye and ear. Follow it back to the zero field. There's only metaphors and puns. It tells us then that there is no seeking, 'cause what connects us is one.